In this episode, why we get fat and what we can do about it, quick core workouts, cheat meals, how to warm up, what to eat before you drink alcohol, competition in cold weather, danger of low body fat, and why exercise won't make you thin.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, Ben Greenfield here. You know, a few weeks ago I was able to look over a manuscript that came across my desk that was the preview of a book about why we get fat and what we can do about it. And even though the book doesn't come out and probably won't come out for quite some time, I was able to get the author of that book on today's interview because there was some information in there that I thought would be really beneficial for you, whether you're trying to lose a lot of weight or you're trying to just take control of your health or maintain weight. Now, we have a pretty jam-packed listener Q&A today, but before we go on to our special announcements and to that listener Q&A, just a couple clarifications. The first is that there will not be a podcast released next week in terms of the official Ben Greenfield Fitness podcast. You will get an Inner Circle podcast next week, but because I'm competing in the Hawaii Ironman World Championships and very busy rushing around in Kona, Hawaii, getting ready for that race, there will not be a podcast released on Wednesday next week, but you can look forward to an Inner Circle podcast released on Monday. The other announcement is that last week, I know that I told you that I'm not writing for Triathlete Magazine anymore, and I just wanted to clarify what the policy of that magazine is. It's not that you not write at all for any other magazines. It's that you not write for other magazines that are in the triathlon industry. Either way, the offer still stands. If you want to go email the editors of Triathlete Magazine and let them know that you'd like to see my articles in that magazine and that it doesn't actually confuse you to see my articles in that magazine and other triathlon magazines as well, feel free to do so. All right, enough with my rant. Let's go ahead and move on to this week's special announcements.
Special announcements.
Well, as I mentioned, I'm competing in the Hawaii Ironman World Championships of Triathlon next week, and because of that, I'm also doing a special promotion for the Triathlon Dominator package over at triathlondominator.com. And beginning on October 4th, or specifically Sunday, October 3rd at midnight, all the way through until I cross the finish line on October 9th at the Ironman World Championships, I'm adding a ton of new bonuses into my Triathlon Dominator package, specifically an audio release entitled Top 10 Mistakes Made by Triathletes, a three-month off-season training program, a special ticket to any of my triathlon camps, a new manual that teaches you how to qualify for the Ironman World Championships, and three-day VIP access to the Rockstar Triathlete Academy. So if you want access to any of those bonuses, if you already own Triathlon Dominator, you'll automatically be getting it. And if you get Triathlon Dominator anytime between now and October 10th, you'll be eligible to get any of those bonuses. Now, in addition, I'm still taking signups for my triathlon training camp in Austin, Texas. So if you're a half Ironman or an Ironman triathlete, be sure to follow the link in the show notes to this episode, episode number 114, to go check out that triathlon camp and reserve your spot. Remember that it's January 31st through February 7th, 2011, and that date will be here very quickly before you know it. So make sure that you sign up if you want to go join me for an all-inclusive training camp in Austin, Texas. And the weather is beautiful that time of year down there, or at least it has been so far for our training camp. And then finally, for those of you who didn't pick it up last week, I do have a new package available that I'm offering to people who want to use me as a nutrition, a health, or a fitness, or triathlon coaching consultant, but don't actually need me to write out your plan. Maybe you already have a coach, maybe you already have a training plan that you're following, but you just want unlimited access to me to be your consultant, to ask me all the questions that you ever have at any time. I do have a new package that you can find in the link that I'll put to the show notes or in the show notes that allows you to have unlimited email access to me whenever you need it to be your personal consultant for health, fitness, and nutrition. If that's something that interests you, it's $175 a month and you can sign up on the link that's in the show notes. I have 3 slots left for that package. I'm only taking on 10 people for that unlimited email access package. It's all that I'm actually able to physically do with my limited amounts of time, but there are 3 slots remaining for that particular package. All right, let's go ahead and move on to this week's listener Q&A.
Listener Q&A.
If you have a question, you can email Ben at bengreenfieldfitness.com. You can Skype to username Pacific Fit. And you can also call 877-209-9439. I realize that there have been a couple of episodes in the past where folks have called in, asked a question, and left either their email address or their phone number. And in the editing process, I have actually not removed the email address and phone number. That is not something I've done on purpose. Usually it just falls through the cracks. But I guarantee that in the future, I will be making it a point never to allow anyone's personal contact information to be released on the podcast. I apologize to those of you who have had your contact information released. If you decide to call in and ask a question, I will be policing that far more intensively in the future. Your phone number and email address will never show up in a question. So with that assurance, you can call 877-209-9439 if you have a question. And the first question this week is from Sean. Sean says, like many people, I have a hectic work schedule and busy family life. Any tips on some good 15 to 20 minute core workouts I can do in home or in my office when I just don't have time to make it to the gym? Well, in my opinion, this is one of those what I would call teach a man to fish questions, because I could just fire off some quick core routine to you, or I could instead teach you how to actually design your own core routine. So essentially, when you're sitting in your office thinking, gosh, it would be nice if I could do an ab workout right now or a core workout right now, you'll want to focus on a few specific elements. The first is you want to split your abdominal section into essentially 4 different areas. You've got your left side, your right side, your front, and your back, because your core is like one big muscular belt that surrounds your midsection. And if you can choose a series of exercises that targets each of those sections, then you're going to get a complete core workout. And essentially, all you're going to do is choose the exercises, put them together into a circuit, and then go as many times through that circuit as you're able to go during the time that you have available. Now, some of the exercises that you can do for the front of your abs, and these are exercises that you'd be able to do with no equipment in an office, would be, of course, crunches or sit-ups, but there's a multitude of variations on those. For example, you can do 6-inch crunches or crunches with your legs off the ground. Anytime you do crunches with your legs off the ground, you're going to target more of your lower abdominal muscles. And don't get me wrong here, I'm not saying that crunches are the best abdominal exercises, but when you have limited space to do an ab workout, they can be something quick, and they also have what I call a low barrier to entry, meaning that, you know, sometimes they're not a hard exercise to start. They get you in the mood to exercise. So for example, you could do 15 crunches or 15 crunch variations. Next, for the side of your abs, you could do a side plank or a side plank raise. And you can look at any of these exercises on my free video database over at pacificfit.net. That's Pacific like the ocean, fit like fitness.net. Side planks or side plank raises. You could do side crunches. You could do torso twists either in the seated position, or you could do torso twists in the standing position if you happen to have an elastic band available. But essentially, any type of side plank movement or torso twist type of movement would be the second exercise that you choose in the sequence. And then finally, for your low back, you can do extension type of exercises. For example, you can lie on your stomach and lift all four limbs off the ground. That's called a Superman exercise. You can do extensions on a stability ball if you happen to have a stability ball available. You can do deadlifts if you happen to have a couple of weights available that you can bend down and pick up off the ground. Finally, another exercise that works not only the low back, but also the stabilizing muscles on the front and on the sides is the front plank exercise, or any variation of the front plank exercise, like being in a front plank and tapping your feet or reaching forward with alternating hands. Those type of exercises work well also. So essentially, that's the way that you would put together your exercises, and you simply do your 15, 20, 25 reps of an exercise, however many reps it takes to fatigue that muscle, then move on to the next muscle group and continue to go through that circuit for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. I have published a couple of quick office workouts over at the YouTube channel for Ben Greenfield Fitness, which is youtube.com/BenGreenfieldFitness. So go through there, scroll through some of the uploaded videos, and check out some of the workouts that I've put up there. So the next question is from Try Hollywood, and he asks a two-part question via Twitter. And if you want to ask a question via Twitter, just go to twitter.com and do a search for Ben Greenfield, or go to twitter.com/BenGreenfield, click follow, and you will be able to ask me a question. And Try Hollywood asks, how much does a cheat or reward meal screw up your metabolism? Well, contrary to popular belief, it's very difficult to screw up your metabolism. Essentially, in order to screw up your metabolism, you have to reset the set point of your body's metabolism, meaning that you have to somehow convince your body to either burn far fewer or far greater calories than it would under normal circumstances. Now, usually when you're talking about screwing up the metabolism, you're talking about burning far fewer calories than you would actually desire to burn. And the way that you can do that is by going on a very low-calorie, restrictive diet for several consecutive days, and typically it's going to take weeks or months before you actually do some severe metabolic damage. But essentially what happens at that point is you reset your metabolic point, and if you naturally burn 1,500 calories per day, your body going into its survival mode would naturally burn closer to, say, 1,000 calories per day. So that's how screwing up your metabolism would actually work. Now, a cheat meal does not screw up your metabolism. A cheat meal, of course, by definition, is not restricting your calories, but giving your metabolism extra calories. If anything, a cheat meal will temporarily speed up your metabolism. However, a cheat meal can inhibit your results if it's done on a frequent basis. For instance, if you're doing consistent cheat meals every day of the week, or dinner is always your cheat meal, or you always have a dessert cheat every day, that's where it can come back to bite you. However, if you're doing a cheat meal, say, once a week, that can actually work out pretty well. That actually comes into what I use as a refeeding strategy for folks who I have on an exercise plan with somewhat restricted calories throughout the week. We'll actually put a cheat meal or a cheat day in at the end of the week to refill the body's energy levels, to refresh mentally, and then to be able to essentially go to town again for the next 6 days and really get a lot of work done. And what you'll notice is a nice weight loss effect that, sure, may not be quite as big as if we didn't put that cheat meal or cheat day in, but the actual weight loss tends to last for a lot longer period of time, meaning using that scenario, that stair-stepping scenario of 6 days of good eating and good exercise, and then one day off with eating, you know, fairly liberally, you'll notice people can go for sometimes a year, year and a half, 2 years maintaining their diet like that. Whereas somebody who lives like a monk 7 days of the week tends to fall off the bandwagon after just a couple of months. So that's where the cheat meals can come in handy, or the reward meals can come in handy. I personally have a cheat meal or a reward meal at least once a week. Typically, a cheat meal might occur for me on a Friday or a Saturday evening, especially if I'm going to end up going out to a restaurant. And then a reward meal will typically happen for me after I've done a very difficult workout, or, for example, a triathlon or a race. Case in point, I did a 20-mile run 3 days ago, and I went out for frozen yogurt with Heath pieces, Butterfinger pieces, Reese's peanut butter pieces, peanut butter, and chocolate fudge on top afterwards. Granted, I did not end up eating dinner that night. I was so full. But yes, cheat meals can work. So the second part of Try Hollywood's question is, what's the best way to warm up when starting a strength or resistance session? The first thing is that over on my other podcast, the Get Fit Guy podcast, I did do a pretty comprehensive podcast episode and article that covers the topics of warming up and cooling down. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But essentially, you'll see most people warming up the wrong way at a gym, meaning that they'll do the very stereotypical 5 minutes of cardio plus a brief stretch and then on to their routine. While the cardio is good for warming up the muscles, the type of cardio that you'll see a lot of people doing, for example, riding a stationary bike, isn't quite as good as something that uses all the body parts. So, for example, doing a warm-up on an elliptical trainer that uses your arms, or doing a warm-up by running on a treadmill, or doing a series of jumping jacks is a much better full-body warm-up. And then from there, there's no need to actually go into stretching. Instead, go into what I call movement preparation, where you're doing dynamic stretching. That would be, for example, a series of arm swings and leg swings. There are exercises as well that you can do, such as lunges with twists, or even body weight or very lightweight variations of full body exercises, like a squat to overhead press, or for example, a push-up with rotation that you might do later on in the workout. You can actually just use body weight versions of your regular workout to warm your body up. That's a much better and more effective warm-up than simply doing static stretching, which can actually reduce the force capacity that you're able to produce in the workout itself. The only muscles I tend to statically stretch prior to a workout, meaning to stretch and hold, are muscles that I tend to easily injure. For example, I will do a static stretch for my IT bands prior to a weightlifting workout because my IT bands tend to get very tight. And so rather than just doing, say, side-to-side leg swings to stretch out my IT band, I'll also get down on the ground and pull my knee in towards my chest to stretch the IT band even more. So that's just an example of a consideration when you're warming up. But go read the article that I'll put in the link to the show notes. And if you guys don't listen to the Get Fit Guy podcast, it's just a very quick 5 to 10 minute podcast that I put out on a weekly basis, along with an article that accompanies the podcast. And it covers sometimes more basic fitness topics than we cover on this show. Typically, it doesn't get into nutrition in detail, but also covers more advanced topics as well. For example, this last week's topic was whether or not yoga actually works for weight loss. So let's move on to a question from Meredith. Meredith says, I'm planning to partake in just a few drinks next weekend. So my question is, should I eat a carb appetizer or protein before I have my first drink, or does it matter? Well, the quick physiology of drinking is that drinking alcohol is going to produce a metabolic byproduct of alcohol breakdown called acetate in your system. And acetate is going to preferentially be burnt as a fuel over anything that you eat, carbohydrates, proteins, or fats. So ultimately, the less that you can eat when you drink, the less you're going to risk weight gain when you drink. But drinking can cause acidity, it can cause a drop in testosterone levels, and there can be some metabolic issues with alcohol consumption that go beyond simple empty calories. And so it can be useful to put your body into a state where it's better able to absorb some of that alcohol that you're consuming. And in that case, the best thing to go for would actually be a higher protein, higher fat meal. For example, a sample meal prior to drinking might be an egg omelet with a little bit of cheese added. Or you could do something like almond butter spread over vegetables with some olives or avocado on the side. You know, so primarily you're looking at a fat-based or a protein-based meal before you have your first drink, and then you're going to want to stay very hydrated afterwards. Sometimes I'll do the kind of the backwards approach. If I don't want to drink much, but I'm drinking to feel my alcohol, I'm drinking to get a buzz, then what I'll do is not eat anything before I drink, but very soon after I drink, then I'll have that higher fat, higher protein-based meal, like, say, the omelet. Now, of course, what I'm not condoning is that you go on a four-hour bender and then pull into the McDonald's drive-thru and get a couple supersized meals to put a brick in your stomach to be able to absorb all the alcohol. All I'm doing is saying that with the acidity and the drop in testosterone that alcohol is already going to cause, you don't want to supplement that with even more acidity from carbohydrate and starch-based sources, which is why the higher protein, higher fat-based meals can help out quite a bit. Those are also going to be released more slowly into your bloodstream, cause a little bit less of a spike in blood sugar, which you probably already have from the alcohol. And so that's another reason that those would be a better choice if you're going to be drinking. So next question is from Constance. And Constance asks, I noticed that the Spokane Triathlon, and for those of you listening in, that's a local triathlon here that myself and many other local athletes competed in. I noticed that many athletes had difficulty during transitions with cold/numb extremities. What are your tips for cold management during triathlons? Well, first of all, let me say that this is one of those do as I say, not as I do pieces of advice that I'm going to give, because I competed in that triathlon. I won that triathlon, but I was quite uncomfortable during the race because I came out of the water, I hopped on the bike, completely skipped putting on the gloves and the long sleeve top that I had sitting right there on my bike because I wanted to beat everyone else out of transition. And I took off and I was literally watching my hands turn blue as I rode the bike. I came back in and actually had to get assistance from a volunteer putting my running shoes on because I couldn't feel my fingers. So a few of the tips that I have are, number one, think about using a muscle warming cream. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but there's one that's very popular among cyclists that you can also use in a triathlon called Greyhound Muscle Warming Juice. It looks like a deodorant stick and you essentially rub it in places that you want to stay warm, specifically the arms, the legs, the hands, and the feet before a cold event, whether that be a run, a cycling event, a triathlon, a swim, etc. So it's called Greyhound Muscle Warming Cream. I would caution you that when you apply that, make sure that you've already applied anything that you're going to put into your crotch, like a chamois cream, before you've put on that muscle warming cream, because trust me, you don't want to get essential oils full of cayenne pepper in any of those sensitive spots. This is the voice of experience speaking. Also, be sure not to rub your eyes after putting that stuff on. The next thing that you would want to do is think about putting not necessarily a glove, but more like a lobster glove or a mitten in your transition area. That will really help to keep your fingers more warm on the bike. They're quick to put on. You can still shift when you have those on, and they'll help your fingers to warm each other during that ride. The other thing that I'll do during the bike and that I did during this race was I was frequently clenching and unclenching my hands to keep the blood flow going to those hands and to make sure that they weren't actually going to fall off or have to be cut off after the race. I would have pulled out if frostbite was an issue. I actually almost did pull out since I was a little bit scared about that. The next thing that you want to do is make sure that your shoes, if you're doing a triathlon, are they're loose, or you're using elastic shoelaces when you come back in so that you don't have to worry about tying or pulling those shoes on. And you don't have to struggle with the shoes quite as much. Granted, because I didn't wear mittens or gloves on the bike ride, I still had a lot of trouble putting my shoes on in that race. But because I had elastic shoelaces, once I was able to get into my shoes, I didn't have to worry about trying to tie them with cold fingers. And then my final piece of advice would be to make sure that you warm up well. You may have noticed that before that race, before the swim, I was doing jumping jacks and push-ups rather than getting into the water and swimming because I knew that the water was going to cool me down more than it would warm me up. you have an elastic band that you can bring to a triathlon that also works quite well for helping to warm you up before a cold weather race or before a race where you may not get a chance to warm up much in the water. So that's a great question in terms of cold management during triathlons. We are getting towards the end of the season, so I would imagine there aren't going to be a lot more cold triathlons coming up here. But if you're planning on an early season spring triathlon or late winter triathlon next year, there are some tips for you. And the other thing is make sure that you really do dry off before you take off on that bike. That'll help as well. All right, next question is from Payam. Payam asks, you often suggest quinoa as a healthy alternative to other sources of carbs. However, I have read that it is high in saponins, which are essentially a poison. Is this true, and what steps should be taken to minimize the saponin content? Well, for those of you who don't know what quinoa is, it's a plant-based food, it's a grain, it's very high in amino acid content, it's a wonderful alternative to rice, to oatmeal, and it's highly nutritious. It's not only got tons of protein, but it's a great source of fiber. It's a good source of stabilized energy levels. It's one thing that I tend to carbohydrate load on, especially in the week before a triathlon or a race. And it's a really great food. It actually is considered a superfood. It's also gluten-free, and it's fairly easy to digest. The issue is that quinoa, in its natural state, has this this kind of resin-like coating around the outside of it called a saponin. And a saponin kind of imparts quinoa or gives quinoa a bitter taste. And it might be that these saponins are designed to keep fungi and microbes from feeding on the natural quinoa plant. And it can also serve as an anti-feedant, meaning it can keep grazing animals from mowing down too much of the quinoa. And some saponins actually can help with animal digestion, but in many cases, saponins can cause some issues with human digestibility, specifically because they are able to poke little holes in cell membranes. They can cause some inflammation and some disruption of metabolic activity in the intestines and in the gut as they travel through the gut and as the quinoa is digested and absorbed. Now, many of the saponins are actually removed during the rinsing and the washing process that takes place as the quinoa is harvested and packaged and sent out to where you get it from the grocery store, wherever else. You do get a lot of trace saponins still there, and that's where doing more washing of the quinoa can help quite a bit. So you can put it in a strainer and rinse it very thoroughly with water. But you can also actually soak your quinoa, and this can help out quite a bit. We actually soak our quinoa, and it not only removes a lot of the saponins, but it also improves digestibility. And you simply soak it in a bowl overnight, and then you rinse it well afterwards, again, using a strainer, and the saponins really will not be an issue after you do that. And interestingly, here's your fun fact for the day. In South America, where quinoa is used quite a bit, they'll strain it and they'll get the saponin out, and then they'll use the saponin as a detergent for washing clothes and also as an antiseptic, again, because it can break through cell membrane walls. It can be used as an antibacterial and as an antiseptic. So there you go. And we've got lots of recipes for quinoa, especially inside the Body Transformation Club that I run. At Ben's Body Transformation Club, I do tons of recipes for folks and video record recipes and workouts. And one of the things that we use quite a bit over there is quinoa. And you can get into the Body Transformation Club by going to bengreenfieldfitness.com/bodytransformationclub. So the next question is from Chuck. And Chuck says, with my history of an eating disorder, I've been diagnosed with low testosterone. A few years back, I went to a specialist, and they told me my low testosterone was due to my body fat levels being so low. Is my low testosterone a cause of not eating enough fat in my diet, or would it be a cause of having too low a body fat percentage? Well, in past podcasts, we've discussed body fat percentages and how much body fat we actually need. And when you're talking about body fat that you actually need, what that is that's your essential body fat. So you get essential fat that's stored in your bone marrow, in your organs, in your central nervous system, in your muscles, and that's actually needed for the normal healthy functioning of those body systems. Your body actually relies on that storage body fat for for the use of the fat as energy for metabolic activity, but also for insulation, cushioning, warmth, things of that nature. For men, that's about 3%. So if your body fat drops below 3%, you're going to lose a lot of that essential body fat. And for women, if you drop below about 12%, that's where you start to lose that essential body fat as well. And for women, that also dips into your normal female reproductive function. So there have been studies that have looked at folks who have eating disorders and some of the things that happen with the hormones that go along with those eating disorders. And these problems are not just with levels of fat that are too low, but also a drop in your ability to produce hormones, to produce energy, just because of a general lack of nutrients due to the low caloric intake. So your gonadotropin levels drop, which is your what's called your follicle stimulating hormone, and your luteinizing hormone levels, and your gonadotropin releasing hormone as well. And if the name of that hormone gives you any clue, the gonadotropin releasing hormone and the other gonadotropin based hormones are essential for sexual activity and the production of sex hormones and normal reproductive function in both males and females. You'll get a drop in growth hormone and a drop in growth hormone releasing hormone. A lot of the thyroid, especially T4 and T3, tend to drop, as does your thyroid stimulating hormone, your TSH levels. Corticotropin releasing hormone, again, an essential hormone for stabilizing your cortisol levels, that tends to get decreased, and your leptin levels, which help your body's appetite to stabilize, tend to fall, and your ghrelin levels, which increase your appetite, tend to rise. So there's a lot of issues that happen. Interestingly, almost every single one of these issues is completely reversible with renutrition or a good refeeding protocol. So a slight rise in the body fat percentage and a return to normal caloric consumption. However, the meat of your question, no pun intended, is whether the drop in testosterone levels is due to a low dietary intake of fat or a low body fat percentage, and it's more likely due to the former, a low dietary intake of fat, because cholesterol is the precursor to all your steroid hormones, including testosterone. And so if you have low levels of circulating cholesterol because you're getting low cholesterol from a restricted dietary fat consumption, you are going to limit your production to produce steroid hormones more than if you have a low body fat percentage. There are a lot of guys, you know, you think about a bodybuilder, for example, or an athlete, you know, walking around with 5 to 10% body fat levels who have testosterone levels through the roof. However, if you're on a low-fat diet, that's a great way to suppress the testosterone levels. So what I would look at doing is going back and listening to the episode with Bioletics where we talked about healthy fatty acid intake. My personal fat consumption right now is at about 30 to 35% dietary fat. I'm getting in a ton of fat. I mean, I'm to the point now where I'm putting pads of butter and almond butter in my oatmeal. I'm even using heavy cream in my coffee. Remember, I'm not trying to lose weight. I'm trying to optimize my hormone levels and my recovery. For someone who's trying to lose weight, I would definitely be limiting the fat to a certain extent, especially from a caloric perspective. I wouldn't eliminate the fat, but I wouldn't be on as high a fat percentage consumption as I personally am on. So essentially, I would increase your dietary fat percentage first. And if your body fat's already as low as it probably is, Chuck, it's naturally going to go up just a little bit, but that won't necessarily be a bad thing. Now, the last question is a very, very interesting question. It's from listener Josie, and Josie sent me a link to an article entitled "Exercise Won't Make You Thin," and she's wondering what I thought about it. So I actually pulled up that article, and what I want to do is go over that article, and I did this a few months ago with an article that appeared in Time magazine about exercise and people not getting not losing weight from exercise. And I kind of like to do the same thing that I did with that article with this article. Specifically, I want to read it and give my thoughts to you as I read it. So we're going to finish with this before we move on to our interview with Jonathan Baylor. But I want to go over this article, read it to you, and give you my thoughts. And then if you have thoughts, be sure to leave a comment on this podcast show notes for episode number 114. So this article is written or released in something called The Guardian, and I'm actually not even seeing an author for this article, interestingly. Oh, yes, there we go. Emma John, the deputy editor of The Observer magazine. Here it goes. My mom used to complain that she couldn't lose weight. A size 18 and a couple of stone heavier than ideal, she tried in vain for years to shed the extra. Every week she headed to the gym where she pounded the treadmill like a paratrooper, often three times a week. Most days she took the dog for a brisk walk. She didn't eat unhealthily. The rest of the family ate exactly the same meals and did a fraction of the exercise she did. She ought to have been the slimmest of the bunch. That she remained overweight was a frustration to her and a mystery to all of us. From Stairmasters to kettlebells, we understand and expect that getting in shape is going to require serious effort on our part. And the reverse is true, too. We expect exercise to pay back the hours of boring, sweaty graft with a leaner, lighter body. We've known that the healthiest way to lose weight is through exercise. It's science, isn't it? Well, science has some bad news for you. More and more research in both the UK and the US is emerging to show that exercise has a negligible impact on weight loss. That tri-weekly commitment to aerobics class, almost worthless as far as fitting into your bikini is concerned. The Mayo Clinic, a not-for-profit medical research establishment in the US, reports that in general, studies have demonstrated no or modest weight loss with exercise alone, and that an exercise regime is unlikely to result in short-term weight loss beyond what is achieved with dietary change. It sounds faintly heretical, if not downright facetious, and it's a scientific discovery that most health professionals are naturally keen to downplay. All right, this is Ben Greenfield now. I want to make an observation. These studies that are being cited relied on cardiovascular exercise, on aerobic exercise. So I want to let you know that they were not using resistance training or interval training when they were comparing whether exercise alone would get you benefit compared to just dieting, or if exercise and dieting would give you benefit compared to just dieting. So these studies that she's citing up there, those are aerobic studies, not with resistance training, not with cardio intervals. So she goes on. She says, most of us have a grasp of the rudiments of weight gain and loss. You put energy into your body through food, you expend them through movement, and any that don't get burned off are stored in your body as fat. Unfortunately, the math isn't in our favor. In theory, of course, it's possible that you can burn more calories than you eat, says Dr. Susan Jebb, head of nutrition and health research at the Medical Research Council. But you have to do an awful lot more exercise than most people realize. To burn off an extra 500 calories is typically an extra 2 hours of cycling, and that's about two donuts. Well, let me interject here that if you ride a bicycle for 2 hours and you're only burning 500 calories, somebody needs to light a fire under you. This is Ben Greenfield commenting again. But that's a severe underestimation of the amount of calories most people burn with 2 hours of cycling if they are really serious about their exercising. For the folks who are reading a novel on the bike, that might be a different case. From a practical perspective, then, exercise is never going to be an effective way of slimming unless you have the training schedule and the willpower of an Olympic athlete. It's simple math, says Professor Paul Gately of the Carnegie Weight Management Institute in Leeds. If you want to lose a pound of body fat, then that requires you to run from Leeds to Nottingham. But if you want to do it through diet, you just have to skip a meal for 7 days. Both Jeb and Gately are keen to stress that there is plenty of evidence that exercise can add value to a diet. It certainly does maximize the amount you lose as fat rather than tissue, Jeb points out. But Gately sums it up. Most people offered the choice are going to go for the diet because it's easier to achieve. This is, again, where I completely disagree with the author that in order for exercise to be an effective way of slimming, you have to have the willpower of an Olympic athlete. I have been a personal trainer for over a decade. I have helped hundreds of people to lose thousands of pounds, and it can be achieved very easily through a combination of the right type of exercise and diet. These professors are simply wrong. Most people offered the choice are not going to go for the diet. They are going to go for dieting plus exercise because in 100% of the cases, you feel better when you're dieting and you're exercising and you get faster results if the exercise is structured properly. So let's go on. There's another more insidious problem with pinning all your hopes for a holiday body on exercise. And what has become a defining experiment at the University of Louisiana, led by Dr. Timothy Church, hundreds of overweight women were put on exercise programs for a six-month period. Some worked out for 72 minutes, some were for 136 minutes a week, and some for 194. A fourth group kept to their normal daily routine with no additional exercise. Against all the laws of natural justice, at the end of the study, there was no significant difference in weight loss between those who had exercised, some of them for several days a week, and those who hadn't. Church identified the problem and called it compensation. Those who exercised canceled out the calories they had burned by eating more, generally as a form of self-reward. The post-workout pastry to celebrate a job well done, or even a few pieces of fruit to satisfy their stimulated appetites, undid their good work. In some cases, they were less physically active in their daily life as well. His findings are backed up by a paper on childhood obesity published in 2008 by Boston academics Stephen Gortmaker and Kendrin Sonneville. In an 18-month study investigating what they call the energy gap, the daily imbalance between energy intake and expenditure, the pair showed that when the children in their experiment exercised, they ended up eating more than the calories they had just burned, sometimes 10 or 20 times as much. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a second. This, what the author is pointing out, is true. You'll get a lot of people who use the 30-minute spin session that they do during their workday lunch hour at the gym to justify going home and sitting in front of the TV for 3 hours while eating popcorn and a couple of dinners. This actually is a problem that you're going to see quite a bit. And this is something where you need to be honest with yourself and ask yourself if you're using exercise as an excuse to sit around the rest of the day or to eat cheat meals every day. We already talked about cheat meals earlier in this episode. Just to give you an example, one of the things that I do, because I know that when I exercise, when I get a good exercise session in, I'm tempted to just kind of sit around the rest of the day. I have a standing workstation. And so when I'm working, I'm in a standing position. And when I'm forced to be in a seated position, I have a rule that I simply do not allow myself to break, that every 45 to 60 minutes, I have to get up and do 100 jumping jacks. That's simply a rule that I give myself. So if you figure out ways, especially if you have a sedentary job, to work in physical activity and make rules for yourself, you tend to overcome this natural propensity to want to sit around, especially if you've already exercised. Okay, we're going to move on. In the 1950s, the celebrated French-American nutritionist Jean Meyer was the first to introduce a link between exercise and weight reduction. Until then, the notion that physical activity might help you lose weight was actually rather unfashionable in the scientific community. Over the course of his career, Meyer's pioneering studies on rats, babies, and schoolgirls demonstrated that the less active someone was, the more likely they were to be fat. Getting fit became synonymous not just with a healthier living, but with a leaner, meaner body, and the ground was laid for a burgeoning gym industry. Each successive post-war generation was enjoying an increasingly sedentary lifestyle, and those lifestyles have been accompanied by an apparently inexorable increase in obesity. But have we confused cause and effect? Terry Wilkin, professor of endocrinology and metabolism at the Peninsula Medical School in Plymouth, argues that we have. The title of his latest research is Fatness Leads to Inactivity, but Inactivity Does Not Lead to Fatness. Wilkin is nearing the end of an 11-year study on obesity in children, which has been monitoring the health, weight, and activity levels of 300 subjects since they were the age of 5. When his team compared the more naturally active children with the less active ones, they were surprised to discover absolutely no difference in their body fat or body mass. That's not to say the exercise is not making the children healthy in other ways, says Wilkin, just that it's having no palpable effect on their overall size and shape. And that's a fundamental issue, he adds, because governments, including ours, use body mass as an outcome measure. In other words, obesity figures are not going to improve through government-sponsored programs that focus primarily on exercise while ignoring the behemoth of a food industry that is free to push high-calorie junk to kids. For one thing, Wilkin believes he has discovered another form of compensation. looking at the question of whether it was possible to change a child's physical activity, Wilkins put accelerometers on children at schools with very different PE schedules, one which offered 1.7 hours a week and another that offered 9 hours. The children did 64% more physical activity at the second school, but when they got home, they did the reverse. Those who had the activity during the day flopped, and those who hadn't perked up. And if you added the in-school and out-of-school together, you got the same. From which we concluded that physical activity is controlled by the brain, not the environment. If you're given a big opportunity to exercise at one end of the day, you'll compensate on the other end. And this is me again interjecting, but I do think that there's something to be said here that we naturally have, like we have a metabolic set point and a physical activity set point, and this could be due to the body's natural survival mechanisms, but it is possible that if you are putting your child or yourself into a structured exercise program, you are fundamentally introducing a mental and physical propensity to exercise less or want to do less physical activity later in the day. Again, I don't think that this means that you are held to that and doomed to that. It just means it's something that you're naturally going to progress towards. But if you're aware of that and you make it a point to stay physically active, even if you've already exercised, then you're still going to be able to overcome this compensation effect that the article is talking about. So we're going to go on. What we want to avoid is people thinking they can control their weight simply by dieting, adds Jeb, who points out that this is the very scenario that encourages anorexia in teenage girls. Just restricting your diet is not going to be the healthiest way to live. Scientific studies show that exercise is an important factor in maintaining weight loss, Jeb adds, and some studies suggest it can help in preventing weight gain. But it is still much harder to exercise when you're already overweight, and high-energy density foods are quick to get us there. Overeating by just 100 calories a day can lead to a weight increase of 10 pounds over a year. Education must come first, says Wilkin. Eating habits have to change to a much lower calorie intake, lower body weight, and we would be fitter as a result because we would be able to do more physical activity. And this is where I find this article to just be very interesting, because you're getting the same researchers who admitted that they found that exercise does not help with weight loss to say that there are studies that show that exercise can help to maintain a steady weight or to help in preventing weight gain. I just don't understand how they can say that on one side and then the other side say that exercise is not going to help with weight loss. In the absence of that compensation effect, and with the right type of exercise, exercise can absolutely lead to weight loss. So the author goes on, when it comes to losing weight, it seems there's only one real choice. Stop eating so much food. The good news, the latest scientific findings from the U.S. suggest that an intense workout in the gym is actually less effective than gentle exercise in terms of weight loss. Barry Braun, associate professor of kinesiology at the University of Massachusetts, says that the evidence emerging from his research team shows that moderate exercise, such as low-intensity ambulation, may help to burn calories without triggering a caloric compensation effect, without making you reach for a snack the moment you're done. In one experiment, Braun showed that simply standing up instead of sitting down used up hundreds more calories a day without increasing appetite hormones in your blood. So, this is interesting because the author who just told us earlier in the article that exercise won't help you lose weight at all is now citing scientific studies that show that low-intensity exercise can help you to burn calories without triggering a caloric compensation effect. In essence, the author is using a study from the U.S. to tell people that they should exercise at a low intensity and not do hard exercise or cardiovascular intervals because of a study that showed that low-intensity exercise doesn't trigger a caloric compensation effect. Again, just a ton of contradiction in this article. Essentially, what this comes down to is that, yeah, low-intensity exercise may help to burn calories without triggering a caloric compensation effect, but as a matter of fact, the research studies are far more comprehensive and elegant that have been done that have showed that low-intensity exercise offers you no advantage over simply dieting. So this throws this part of our argument completely into the trash and weakens the earlier point of the article. And then she goes on, and almost done here, she says, perhaps offering one reason for a multi-billion pound weight loss industry aimed almost exclusively at women, research has confirmed that it is more difficult for women to shed the pounds than men because women's bodies are simply more efficient at storing fat. In one of Braun's experiments in which overweight men and women were monitored while walking on treadmills, the women's blood levels of insulin decreased while appetite hormones increased. The men's, meanwhile, displayed no such change. Across the evidence base, it seems that it's tougher for women to lose weight than men, affirms Ken Fox, professor of exercise and health sciences at Bristol University. I think that we all know that this fact is true. Women have a higher body fat percentage. They have higher needs for essential body fat because of the female reproductive system, because of the breasts, the hips, the thighs, and the butt naturally storing more body fat. This is completely natural. I think that if you're listening and you're a woman, this is not something that should discourage you. It's something that should make you take pride that you are built differently than a man. This is one of the reasons that you are able to be attractive to men. And I don't want to get into the sexuality argument too much here, but I think it's okay that women are slightly fatter than men. I think that that is completely natural. Yes, that means that it may be tougher for you to lose weight, but I think that comparing the weight loss of men to the weight loss of women is like comparing apples to oranges. This author finally finishes by listing a ton of foods and then listing how long it would actually take to burn those foods. For example, she says a Mars bar would take 50 minutes of aqua aerobics. A Subway tuna wrap would take 1 hour and 10 minutes of body pump. A slice of Domino's pepperoni pizza would take 45 minutes of swimming. Well, this is a perfect place to end because, remember, folks, it's not just the calories that you eat. It is the source of those calories. And we're going to talk more about that in today's featured topic with Jonathan Baylor. So let's go ahead and move on to that interview.
Featured topic.
Hey, folks, this is Ben Greenfield. And occasionally things come across my desk that really raise my eyebrow in terms of me seeing that somebody has really gotten a grasp on being able to give us a very good idea about what makes people tick when it comes to being healthy and when it comes to being smart about specifically fat loss and weight loss. And there is a gentleman, Jonathan Baylor, who lives over in Seattle, and he has done a pretty extensive amount of investigative journalism into why we as a culture aren't losing weight and what some of the problems are in terms of our approach to fat loss. I've seen some of the findings and some of the research that he has actually been able to dig into and make palatable for the average person to be able to understand. He is going to be later on in 2012 putting all this information into a book, but I didn't want you to have to wait until then to at least get an idea of what Mr. Jonathan Baylor has actually found when it comes to fat loss, weight loss, and your health. So, Jonathan, thanks for coming on the call today.
Hey, my pleasure, Ben.
So before we get into what exactly is the reason that people aren't losing weight and why people have such a hard time burning fat, what inspired you to get involved with looking into this in the first place?
Oh, well, it's a great question, Ben. About 10 years ago, I was actually a personal trainer, so I do have a bit of background in the industry, but I'm really just fundamentally a geek at heart. My day job currently is software engineering, so I've just had a passion for sort of, you know, really digging into the real sort of research and clinical sort of studies that have gone on about fat loss. And I've just been fascinated how we as a culture, you know, exercise more than any other culture in the world, and we diet more than any other culture in the world, and yet we're still fatter than every other culture in the world. That really didn't make sense to me. And I really wanted to just find out why that was taking place. So I just hit the books and came up with some pretty surprising findings.
Now, I want to jump right into the meat of some of the things that you found. And
You know, I know that there's a lot that we could talk about, but I want to specifically dig into some of the things that I thought were most interesting that we haven't talked about too much on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast before. And the first is the issue that there are actually foods that you can eat that can cripple your ability to burn fat. I think a lot of people don't realize that. Can you talk about the reasoning behind that and which foods can actually cripple the ability to burn fat?
Absolutely. This really gets to, you hit the nail on the head, you know, a big sort of gist of my book and my research. And that sort of people, as a culture, we really focus on the need to burn fat, like this sort of calories in versus calories out equation. And this myth that if we just exercise more or eat less, we will automatically burn fat. Well, as we all know, just needing something is not enough, right? I'm losing my hair. I need to grow some hair back, but that doesn't mean I'm going to actually grow my hair back because my body doesn't have the ability to regrow hair, at least not yet. Hopefully science will fix that. But food can actually do the same things to our bodies. For example, high fructose corn syrup, which I'm sure everyone has heard of is terrible for us, is actually not recognized by our body as a food and actually has metabolic consequences, which basically say our body can no longer burn fat effectively. When it is prompted to burn fat, when we, you know, burn more calories, what our body will in fact do is simply prompt us to eat more or prompt itself to burn muscle tissue rather than burning fat, because these unnatural foods that we've put in our body have essentially clogged our ability to burn fat. So we can create the need all day, but we've sabotaged our ability to actually burn that fat. It's actually very fascinating.
Can you go into a little bit more detail about how that actually happens and give some examples? I know a lot of people really know that high fructose corn syrup is bad for them. But are there things that go beyond that? And if so, how's that actually happening? How is the body losing its ability to burn fat as it consumes these foods?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So I'm sure a lot of people are very familiar with the fact that we as a culture have an incredibly high rate of what's called type 2 diabetes. And this is, you know, adult onset diabetes or diabetes that, you know, is not a genetic consequence. We're doing and we're eating something that's causing us to become diabetic. Another condition very similar to this is called insulin resistance. And these are all a consequence of what I would call the sort of fundamental crippling of our ability to burn fat. And what happens, without geeking out too much, is that when we eat foods that are very high in the sugar, essentially, or starches, basically all of our sort of breads and grains and sweets, what it triggers is a lot of a hormone called insulin in our bodies. And when we produce all this excess insulin, we build up a resistance to it. So if we eat a lot of foods, it causes us to trigger a lot of insulin. We'll have sort of just insulin sticking around in our bloodstream. And when insulin is present in our bloodstream, our body will never burn fat. And the reason this happens is our body, it just sees insulin in our bloodstream as an indication that we have enough food. Because we traditionally would only release insulin when we eat a lot of food, but nowadays we're eating the types of food that cause an excess amount of insulin to be released. So we have this sort of ever-present state in our bodies of insulin. So our bodies never really think we need to burn fat, and that really sabotages our ability for our body to burn fat. So here again, from our perspective, we've created the need. We've created this negative caloric balance, but you have this ever-present increased level of insulin in our bodies, which to our body's perspective says, well, I don't need to burn fat. I don't have the ability to burn fat. I've got all this insulin sticking around. You can do whatever you want. With all this insulin in my bloodstream, I can't burn fat. And the reason for that, again, without really geeking out, is there's myriad hormones that are required, such as glucagon and adrenaline and epinephrine, that are required for our body to actually break down stored fat, which is called triglyceride, into free fatty acids, which we can then burn as fat. None of this can happen when we have things like insulin present in our bloodstreams. And this is why, you know, we've heard, you know, these low glycemic diets or these Atkins diets. The reason some people see a lot of great results on those diets is they do really target sort of minimizing the amount of insulin in the bloodstream. Of course, the problem with these diets is they also potentially minimize the amounts of very healthy foods such as vegetables, and that's not the right thing to do. But fundamentally, they are on to something in a sense that, you know, people on the Atkins diet will eat a lot of food and still burn a lot of fat, because what they've done is restored their body's ability to burn fat by getting rid of all this excess insulin in their bloodstream.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think a lot of people are used to having constantly high levels of sugar coming in and not even used to the feeling of burning fat. I know that you, as somebody who's physically active and who exercises, Jonathan, you've probably bonked during exercise or felt low blood sugar during exercise, and it can be somewhat uncomfortable, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and
I think it's. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh well. I was going to say, I think that a lot of people, you know, even when they're not exercising, if they put their body into fat metabolizing mode in the way that you're recommending by decreasing the presence of these constantly high insulin levels, that it's initially uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and you know, in addition to sort of being uncomfortable, it's very interesting because there's been, you know, many studies done at, you know, very prestigious universities such as Harvard that show that a lot of these insulin-triggering foods actually have the same addictive characteristics, such as drugs like opium or heroin, causing the same sort of serotonin and dopamine triggers in our brain, so that when we do try to, you know, break what is literally a sugar and starch addiction, we go through a mild case of withdrawal, because these chemicals are causing, you know, the same sort of drug-like addictive dependencies that, you know, much more sort of hardcore drugs do cause. And that, again, is really crippling our ability. And if you've ever tried to give up sugar, you sort of definitely experience, it's like trying to give up coffee. You're going to go through a little bit of a withdrawal. It's not a fun process.
Yeah, and I think even beyond the withdrawal process that people go through, you begin to burn a different fuel. When you tap into fat, you're tapping into into basically what are called ketones or fatty acids, and those produce energy in a different way. And I know a lot of folks that I talk to have switched from these high insulin levels. They just feel a little bit blah for a few weeks when they first make that switch, and then your body learns how to burn fat.
Absolutely. And then it's actually, you know, a pretty incredible feeling, because instead of having those peaks and valleys, which I think we experience a lot as a culture, as we can see by sort of the prevalence of energy drinks that have now swept the market, you know, it's to bring us up out of those peaks. When we get off of, you know, running off of a sugar or a starch high and then having to drink, you know, a can of, you know, a further sugar inducing, you know, energy drink, we can have, you know, that constant level of fuel, just like a slow burning fire going on in our bodies, which kind of keeps us up all day, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you talk in your book a little bit about how someone can actually burn fat without changing the number of calories that we eat. And I know that people probably are somewhat familiar with the idea that maybe the calories in versus the calories out equation isn't all that there is to life and weight loss. But in your words, how can somebody take their diet, still eat the same number of calories, but still lose weight? And how would you explain that?
Cool. Hey, so yeah, this is one that, you know, really gets me a little bit fired up, because we hear this myth all the time that a calorie is a calorie. I'm sure folks have heard that phrase before, and that's just silly, right? That's like saying that Vanilla Ice and Mozart are the same because they're both musicians. You know, that's absolutely not true. So a very simple example is that the way our bodies process various calories is fundamentally different. So, you know, fat, for example, takes very little metabolizing to sort of become usable energy within our body. Same thing with, you know, highly processed sugar. But let's talk for a moment about protein. We hear about high protein diets and why protein is so valuable. Well, without getting too much into math, if you eat 100 calories worth of protein, before that protein is available for your body to store as fat or burn as energy, it has to go through an immense amount of processing. And the reason for this is that, you know, when we eat protein, it breaks down to what's called amino acids. And amino acids can be used for all kinds of things in the body, but one of them is not, or two of them, excuse me, are not to be burnt as energy, because our body fundamentally, like Ben said, only burns two things as energy, and that's, you know, ketones and glucose, or it can be used to be stored as fat. But before amino acids, which is what protein turns into after it's digested, can be turned into glucose so that they can be metabolized by our body, an immense amount of processing has to take place. And that active processing burns an immense amount of calories. In nutrition fields, this is called dietary induced thermogenesis, which basically just means digesting food burns a heck of a lot of calories. In fact, for the average American, about 10% of the calories we burn a day is spent simply digesting food. Now, if we change the type of calories we eat, we change the quality of calories we eat, we eat a lot of lean protein, we eat a lot of good fats, we eat a lot of fibrous vegetables and fruits, the amount of calories we will actually burn digesting that food increases dramatically. In fact, protein, when you eat it, you will actually burn 70% of the calories that you eat simply turning that protein into metabolizable energy in your body. If you think about that, that is mind-blowing. That means if you eat 300 calories worth of protein, when everything's all said and done, no matter what, if we're in a coma on our bed, the most amount of calories that our body could ever conceivably store as fat would be 100 calories, simply because, you know, about, you know, 66% or 70%, you know, two-thirds of those calories of from lean protein is simply spent digesting it. It's called metabolic inefficiency, and it is absolutely a scientific fact that a calorie is not a calorie, and by changing the quality of calories we eat, we can lose weight without eating any less.
With metabolic, or with the word inefficiency being a good thing in this case for people.
Absolutely. We want our bodies, and in some sense, you know, it's actually funny that you should say that, Ben, because this is actually a key point. I'm very happy you brought it up. Our bodies are fundamentally designed to be very metabolically efficient, right? Like we've evolved over 2.6 million years, and for the vast, vast majority of that time, we're talking like 96% of that time, food was very scarce. We all know that. And our bodies were designed to sort of most efficiently as possible take as many calories as it could and use them for energy and then store them should we run out of food. Obviously, we have no shortage of food in America today. We have an excess of food. So our goal is actually, we're in an incredible position. Instead of eating foods that should maximize metabolic efficiency, we should be eating foods that maximize metabolic inefficiency. And the funny thing is these are just the foods that fundamentally we're designed to eat. Natural meats, natural fish, a lot of natural vegetables, natural fruits, nuts, and seeds. The most healthy foods available are also the most metabolically inefficient foods available and are also the most natural sort of chemical-free foods available. And it's pretty hard to argue that we should simply eat the foods that nature provides us. And it's funny because those are the exact foods that make us metabolically inefficient and make us burn fat. It's quite a sort of virtuous cycle.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, that when I think about this sometimes, in a way, our ability to create efficient foods like, you know, breads, calorie-dense foods, has somewhat crippled us in one way, because we have excess calories around, but we're really not in danger, at least that I'm aware of going through a famine anytime soon. So we're basically eating all these efficient foods that are very convenient, that get us full very quickly, or at least allow us to store away a lot of storage energy, but we really have no need to be storing away that energy. And as you mention in what I've seen so far of your book, that has a pretty stark effect on healthcare costs as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because we have this phenomenon in our country which is really unprecedented. And a gentleman by the name of Michael Pollan, who I'm sure some of your listeners have read his books, developed this term, or he may have not developed it, but he certainly says it a lot, which is we as a culture have become overfed and undernourished. Because what we've done in producing all these efficient foods is they're efficient because we've processed them. We've done what traditionally our bodies would do, and that's we've broken the food down and sort of stripped out all of these things that are difficult to digest, because it's cheaper and food is sort of, you know, we can mark it up on supermarket shelves and we can store it for longer. But then when we eat it, our body really has nothing else to do except it's like, this has already been processed for me. Might as well just stick this in the fat cells. Mm-hmm. And the food has very few nutrients in it. So our body will then just be like, well, I don't have enough nutrients. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to crave some more food. So we have children who are obese and have these quote-unquote archaic diseases like rickets, which is, you know, a fundamental vitamin and mineral deficiency. And you're like, this child, this 10-year-old child weighs 200 pounds and has a vitamin deficiency? How is that even possible? Well, they're eating food that has an immense amount of calories, has been immensely processed, but has no nutrition in it. And that makes us, you know, overfed and undernourished. It's just a shocking phenomenon.
Well, you know, as you and I both know, and I'm sure many of the listeners know, gaining weight and fat loss is not just about nutrition. There's definitely physical activity that has to come into play. And you have some opinions about exercise and what form of exercise is best for maximizing fat loss. For you as an investigative journalist, someone who's looked quite a bit into weight loss and fat loss, what have you found to be most effective for folks in terms of physical activity?
Well, it's a great question, Ben. Again, this is one of these things where, again, this sort of overarching trend that I found in our culture is this focus on quantity, saying, you know, what quantity of food are we eating? We need to eat less food. And then we take it the other direction with exercise. We say, what quantity of exercise are we doing? Let's go do more exercise. Let's spend more time in the gym. But we don't really focus necessarily on what we're doing in the gym. We're just like, oh, I was on the treadmill for an hour. Therefore, I did better than someone who was on the treadmill for a half hour. And that is not at all true. In fact, to fundamentally restore our body's ability to burn fat, to sort of unclog what I call our fat metabolism system, to resensitize our body to insulin and these hormones which cause us to burn fat, what we actually need to do is a much lower quantity and a much higher quality of exercise. And that takes the form of two things, one of which I call high-quality resistance training, and the other which I call high-quality interval training, which is very similar to what a lot of folks, I think, have heard about a little bit in the mainstream, which is, you know, for high-quality interval training, it's doing short, intense bursts of low-impact cardiovascular exercise. And, you know, that can only be done for a very short period of time, but again, it's much more effective at sort of, you know, forcing this clog out of our fat metabolism system. And resistance training is very much the same way. It's a very intense exercise for a very short period of time, forcing our body to sort of make adaptions, which the analogy I use is sort of like trying to move a couch by poking it with a finger. Like, our body will never react if we sit there and just poke at it. We're just, you know, sit there, poke a couch. The couch will never move. You can poke it a million times. You can use any quantity. It will never move the couch. When we do this sort of continuous, low-quality cardio, that's what we're doing. We're poking on our fat metabolism system. We're saying, please burn fat. Please, and the fat metabolism system is like, leave me alone. But when we actually go in there and we do high-quality resistance training, we do high-quality cardio, which, because it's so high quality and so intense, we have to do for a short period of time, we're basically taking that couch and we're giving it one good push, and it slides right across the floor, and we're doing the same thing with our fat metabolism system. We're giving it one good, high-quality push, and we're sort of forcing that clog right out and forcing it to then burn fat.
Interesting. Now, you have the opinion that some of the metabolically inefficient foods are foods that were something that, from an evolutionary standpoint, people were eating for a long period of time. Do you feel that these type of exercise modes perhaps are metabolically inefficient or effective for fat loss for a similar reason, based off of how our body responds to certain modes of exercise in terms of what our ancestors may have done?
Oh, that's a really great question. I mean, I think it is a lot like that. What I found in my research is that I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, just like there's metabolically inefficient foods and metabolically efficient foods, there's metabolically efficient forms of activity and there's metabolically inefficient forms of activity. We're designed to sort of perform low intensity activity for a long period of time. That's what we did. We walked around, we hunted, we gathered. It is easy for our body to do that. We're very efficient at performing that. But when it comes to, you know, oh my gosh, there's a tiger, let me go sprint for 30 seconds to get away from it, or oh my gosh, this boulder fell on my leg, let me lift it up really quick. Those exercises and those activities were not really designed for. So when we perform them, it causes this extreme amount of stress on our bodies, but a good stress in this sense. And for us to recover from that stress, we burn an immense amount of calories and release an immense amount of hormones, which cause us to then have both the need and the ability to burn fat for exactly the reason you mentioned. These are very inefficient activities to perform, and thus, I guess, getting back home to the key message here, which is almost like inefficiency is a good thing in this realm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of people may not realize that. I think of most of the animals or the living creatures on the planet, humans are some of the best at endurance exercise in terms of going and going and going on even low amounts of fuel. And that's something that you actually don't want to do if you want to lose weight. It kind of flies in the face of logic, but you want to stay away from the stuff that you're good at. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, and of course, I think, you know, we can always take this in an unhealthy direction too. So we need to be sensitive to, you know, this doesn't mean, you know, go to your gym and stand on one leg and, you know, spin around and do something. Oh, we're not designed to do that. That's certainly not, I think, what neither Ben nor I are saying. It's much more just like, you know, from a high level. It's about doing things that fundamentally aren't easy. If it's easy to do, chances are it's not going to be producing many results.
Yeah. Now, what about hormones? Do you feel that you mentioned hormones earlier, but how big of an issue at this point are hormones in terms of, you know, say the average American's inability to lose weight?
I mean, I really, Ben, I couldn't stress it more. I mean, I think that we've thought, you know, I like to joke around and I say hormones are the new calories. Like for the past, you know, since the 1970s when, you know, exercise really became mainstream and, you know, monitoring the way we eat really became mainstream, you know, because it wasn't before then. You know, there was one fitness guy, his name was Jack LaLanne, and in the 50s and 60s, people didn't really exercise. In fact, women weren't even allowed to exercise at many universities. But, you know, in the modern era where we do exercise and are sensitive to our diet, at least in this country, we're all about calories. And really, really, that is not what we should be focused on. Our body is controlled by hormones. The easiest way to look at this is, you know, anybody who hits puberty, they're not growing because they're eating more calories. They're eating more calories because a bunch of hormonal things are happening in their body, which are triggering them to grow, which are triggering boys to turn into men and girls to turn into women. The same thing happens to women when they go through menopause. It has nothing to do with calories. These dramatic changes in our bodies have nothing to do with calories and have everything to do with hormones telling our bodies to change. And we can use nutrients, and we can use foods, and we can use exercises to dramatically influence these hormonal issues in our bodies. And once you've taken care of that, like once you get your body hormonally correct, the calories kind of take care of themselves. Because when you're hormonally right, you won't crave and you won't desire these types of foods that cause you to get all out of whack and, you know, overfed and undernourished. So taking a step back and saying, you know, how can we make eating less about calories and more about hormones? And how can we make exercise, especially exercise, because exercise is really easy to do hormonally versus calorically. How can we make exercise more hormonally focused and less calorically focused?
Gotcha. So when you talk about hormones, you're more focusing on kind of these digestive hormones like insulin and glucagon and some of these others that you've mentioned. But in terms of, say, like sex hormones, like estrogen and progesterone, or testosterone, you hear about, you know, industrialization causing us to be exposed to all these what are now termed obesogens or plastics, phytoestrogens, fake estrogens in the environment that are causing, you know, females to gain weight or get breast cancer or go through puberty earlier or males to develop, you know, female characteristics, excess fat or males' testosterone levels to go down. You know, all of these little things. Do you believe that that has something to do with it as well?
You know, it's honestly an area that my research really didn't take me. I certainly would say that anything that is going to cause our bodies to get out of, you know, mm-hmm. anything that will change the hormonal state of our body, I fundamentally believe will have a bigger and more long-term and more meaningful impact on our ability and need to burn fat than we can really ever manually do with a sort of calories in, calories out focus. And the simplest example I can think of this is, you know, we all know people who can eat whatever the heck they want and never gain a pound. They can go and eat an entire cheesecake and they will not put on any weight. And we know another person who can eat a cheesecake flavored Jelly Belly jelly bean and seems to gain 5 pounds. These people are not dealing with a caloric issue. They're dealing with a hormonal issue. And you know, studies after studies after studies have revealed this to be true, where, I mean, you can take sets of twins, and if you take, you know, one set of twins and you feed them both 10,000 calories, and you take another set of identical twins and feed them each 10,000 calories, the two twins will always gain the same amount of fat. But across, so like if we have the Smith twins over here and the Jones twins over here, the Jones twins can gain or lose up to 10 times more or less fat than the Smith twins based on the hormonal state of them. And it's very profound, because the twins allow us to say, if we have two people with the same genes and basically the same hormonal state, they will react the same way to various foods and modalities of exercise. But when you take two people with this different but still the same within their own pair sets of genes and hormones, they will react differently. So it's very, very interesting.
It is. And you know, let's get controversial for a second here. I know that you have directly said that the big business and government are burying all of this information that we've talked about today, especially with regards to the issue with fat loss being far more detailed than calories in versus calories out. You say they're burying all of this so they can keep their oversized profits and budgets. Can you expound on that?
Sure. So this is one which I can go a little bit bananas on, because it really upsets me.
That's fine. I'll try. I'm not afraid of getting shut down.
So I guess I'll start with sort of, I think, the two most salient points, at least for me. One is that time after time after time, a gentleman, for example, by the name of Walter Willett, who's the chair of nutrition at the Harvard School of Nutrition, we've proven that the food guide pyramid, in whatever form — they change it every 5 years, but it's still fundamentally the same thing — is backwards. The food guide pyramid fundamentally says that the foundation of our diet should be starch. From an evolutionary perspective, we did not eat starch until 10,000 years ago. And that seems like a long time, but humans have been around for a lot longer than that. A lot longer than that. In fact, for about 96% of human existence, we ate no starch. And we've got all kinds of studies saying that we really don't need starch. We do need carbohydrate. I'm definitely not an advocate for what I would say are these sort of extreme low carbohydrate diets, but we don't need to get it from starch. And our government — and it's funny, because it's not necessarily all of our government, it's you know, the United States Department of Agriculture — put out this food guide pyramid which says we should base our diet on starch. Now, wait a second. The United States Department of Agriculture, what makes up the backbone of our agriculture business? Corn, wheat, starch. Okay, starts to make a little bit more sense now why we're being recommended to base our diet on starch, even though there's absolutely no science backing it and myriad studies proving it to be terrible and the cause of diabetes and the cause of coronary heart disease and the cause of all these horrible things, like around the metabolic syndrome, if folks have heard of it. But yet we're still told, you know, 6 to 11 servings of a food that we didn't eat for 96% of human history. That blows my mind.
And do you feel that the food pyramid is based on that?
Well, you know, I mean, I I think the food pyramid, I mean, going sort of way back, right, you know, the food pyramid was came out of this thing called, you know, the dietary guidelines, which was put out by a Senate committee in 1977. And there was very little nutritional guidance. It was much more of a politically inspired doctrine that sort of then spun out of control and turned into the food guide pyramid. And now you have companies like General Mills and, I mean, you know, cereal companies, basically, which the cornerstone of their profits is selling cheap starch that is highly refined and generally marketed towards children. And that's where we learn about the food guide pyramid, right? It's on the back of cereal boxes. And what is cereal composed of? Nothing but nutritionless starch. And then you've got the food guide pyramid saying you should eat 6 to 11 servings of starch. So it's this virtuous cycle, which is you've got the government putting out bogus information, and then you've got big business picking that up and sticking, you know, $30 billion marketing budgets behind it and saying, look, the government, which is supposed to take care of you, is saying you should eat 6 to 11 servings of starch. And look, our cereal is a great source of starch. And in fact, our soda is low fat. So you can drink soda and you know, eat starch till you're blue in the face because it's a great source of 6 to 11 grains and they're both low in fat. And it's just this devastating insulin, you know, shitstorm, excuse my language, that is causing us to just spiral into this obesity nightmare. And it's very scary.
So it comes full circle to what we started talking about, that a lot of these metabolically efficient foods are hormonally crippling our ability to burn fat, and at the same time, all of this is being subsidized.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about the way food companies make money, and again, that's one thing we need to keep in mind here, Ben, is that as you know, right, business, food companies aren't out to necessarily make us healthy, right? They're out to make profits for themselves. And that's fine. You know, we can have a separate conversation about that. And how can a big business make money? Well, you know, selling carrots is not very profitable. Carrots are, you know, is a vegetable. There's no processing. It's a commodity. You know, you're not going to make much profit there. But if you can take, you know, corn and do all kinds of crazy stuff to it and turn it into this, you know, packaged thing that doesn't need to be refrigerated, and you've sort of extracted all the nutrients from it and injected a bunch of chemicals which essentially make us become addicted to these food products, well, now food companies can charge you $4 for something which really cost them 4 cents. And, you know, because, you know, starch is incredibly cheap and, you know, big business can buy a lot of it and then they can process the heck out of it and make new foods. I mean, how many food products are in every supermarket? It's ridiculous. You've got the perimeter of the supermarket that has, you know, your meats and your vegetables and your natural foods. And then you have the middle of the supermarket that has like 50,000 invented foods that didn't exist 100 years ago, and that makes up the bulk of our diet, and that makes up the bulk of big business's profit, and that makes up the bulk of the food guide pyramid's recommendations. It really doesn't, well, actually it does make sense to me, but it's unfortunate how it makes sense.
Well, you have a lot of material that we didn't cover today that you've actually you've found in pages and pages and pages of studies that you reference. And I know that it's going to be a little while before all of this comes together, probably around, for those of you listening, 2012, Jonathan's book, which is tentatively going to be titled Hot, Smart, and Healthy, will come out. I will keep you posted over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com because I'm actually following the progress of this book. I'm excited for when it comes out because it is full of a lot of very good information, especially in terms of putting this into terms that are easy to understand for the general population when it comes to fat burning and health and weight loss. So I will keep you posted on the development of this book by Jonathan Baylor. And in the meantime, Jonathan, thank you for coming on the call today.
Oh, my pleasure, Ben. I hope it was useful for your readers, and it was certainly fun for me.
All right, fantastic. Until next time, this is Ben Greenfield and Jonathan Baylor from BenGreenfieldFitness.com signing out.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap up today's podcast. Remember to leave a ranking for this podcast in iTunes. Just go to iTunes, do a search for Ben Greenfield Fitness, leave a ranking, leave a comment. Please be nice. And remember that you can check out the show notes this episode at bengreenfieldfitness.com. You can also get full downloadable transcripts of every episode by going to the link that I've got in the show notes. And those are completely free, along with this podcast. And of course, that leads to my final point. If you want to donate to the podcast, just follow the link that's below any of the posts at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Anybody that donates more than $15 will automatically get sent a bengreenfieldfitness.com t-shirt along with some extra goodies. So until next time, this is Ben Greenfield. Be sure to track the Ironman World Championships at IronmanLive.com if you want to see me suffering next week down in Kona, Hawaii, and that's on October 9th. Finally, the Inner Circle podcast will be released next week, but remember, no BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast next week because I'll be busy racing. All right, folks, have a great week.